You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m. Next up is Fight the Empire.
Good morning. Today is February 16th. My name is Per Fogring, and this is Fight the Empire. And like I said, today is February 16th. It was a day that some people were predicting that Russia was going to invade Ukraine. And as far as I know, last I heard, it hasn't happened yet. President Biden spoke out on Ukraine and talked about a possible Russian invasion. Which hasn't happened yet either, but I'd like to start out with a very interesting article. Actually, it was written, published just a few months ago, in this last December, and it's by Jack Matlock, who was once the ambassador to the Soviet Union back in those days, and this article is called Ukraine: Tragedy of a Nation Divided. This is Jack Matlock writing. Interference by the United States and its NATO allies in Ukraine's civil struggle has exacerbated the crisis within Ukraine, undermined the possibility of bringing the two easternmost provinces back under Kyiv's control, and raised the specter of possible conflict between nuclear-armed powers. Furthermore, in denying that Russia has a right, that's in quote, a right to oppose extension of a hostile military alliance to its national borders, the United States ignores its own history of declaring and enforcing for two centuries a sphere of influence in the Western Hemisphere. He's talking about the Monroe Doctrine. The fact is, this is Matlock going on, the fact is Ukraine is a state but not yet a nation. In the 30 years of its independence, it has not yet found a leader who can unite its citizens in a shared concept of Ukrainian identity. Yes, Russia has interfered, but it is not Russian interference that created Ukrainian disunity, but rather the haphazard way the country was assembled from parts that were not always mutually compatible. The territory of the Ukrainian state claimed by the government in Kyiv was assembled not by Ukrainians themselves, but by outsiders, and took its present form following the end of World War II. To think of it as a traditional or primordial whole is absurd. This applies to the two most recent additions to Ukraine, that is, some eastern portions of interwar Poland and Czechoslovakia annexed by Stalin at the end of the war, and the largely Russian-speaking Crimea, which was transferred from the Russian USSR well after the war, when Nikita Khrushchev controlled the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. That was when Khrushchev sort of gave Crimea to Ukraine, kind of, for whatever reasons. I guess he was in a power rivalry with somebody else in the power structure there. Going back to Jack Matlock, since all constituent parts of the USSR were ruled from Moscow, It seemed at the time a paper transfer of no practical significance. Up to then, the Crimea had been considered an integral part of Russia since Catherine the Great conquered it in the 18th century. The lumping together of people with strikingly different historical experience and comfortable in different languages underlies the current divisions. If one takes Galicia and adjoining provinces in the west on the one hand, and the Donbass and Crimea in the east and south on the other as exemplars, the areas in between are mixed, proportions gradually shifting from one tradition to another. There is no clear dividing line, and Kyiv will be claimed by both. From its inception, an internationally recognized state, Ukraine has been deeply divided along linguistic and cultural lines. Nevertheless, it has maintained a unitary central government rather than a federal one that would permit a degree of local autonomy. The Constitution gave the elected president the power to appoint the chief executives of the provinces rather than having them subject to election in each province. So this article goes on how Ukraine is divided. It's you look at a map and it's like the borders of the state are bigger than the nation itself. The Ukraine forms a smaller part of the what's called Ukraine, and so the Russian speaking people in the at one time they were sort of part of the national structure. In fact, they had a elected president who represented them, Viktor Yanukovych, and he was elected, but he was driven from office apparently because he was offered two kind of financial deals, one from Russia and one from the European Union. And from what I can tell, the terms of the Russian deal were better. They didn't involve any austerity, where the European deal did involve austerity. And so Yanukovych chose the Russian deal, and then that's when the protests, the street protests began, and Yanukovych was forced out of office, and he fled to Russia, and the Ukrainian politicians who were championed by the protests, they took over. So that is. If the listeners have anything to say about this, this is a very dicey situation going on here. It could erupt at any time. NATO is beefing up its forces on its side of the border, and Ukraine supposedly there has been a talk of a. Of Russia pulling back its forces, but apparently this has not happened yet, and so you have this sort of a chancy situation, which could it doesn't take much to set things off. So if anybody wants to call in with a question or a comment, the number to call is 503-231-8187. What do you think about this? This is a situation that could draw the United States into some kind of a war with Russia, and you could almost see it coming in some ways. It's better to see it coming and try to avoid it than to have it all of a sudden erupt and be blindsided by it. One thing I'd like to say is that a lot of this, according to some, this began with back when Bill Clinton was president. There's an article in Counterpunch by Melvin Goodman, who was a former CIA person, and he says the title of the article is Bill Clinton's Role in the Crisis Over Ukraine. And Melvin Goodman writes, the militarization of American foreign policy has evolved over the past 30 years. Ironically, this took place in the wake of the dissolution of the Soviet Union, which should have led to reassessing U.S. national security policy and defense spending. Democratic presidents have played a major role in this militarization because they are unwilling to challenge the Pentagon and the defense industry. Bill Clinton was initially responsible for the militarization. He abolished the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency and began the expansion of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Barack Obama believed that war in Afghanistan was a, quote, good war, and reappointed Robert Gates as Secretary of Defense to appease the uniformed military. President Joe Biden even appointed a retired four-star general to the position of Secretary of Defense and has given diplomacy a backseat in the twin struggles with Russia and China. The post-war presidents understand the need to divide Moscow and Beijing, but Biden has taken actions that have inspired Russia and China to grow closer. Let me go on to the next page here. But it all started with Clinton, whose relations with the Pentagon were tenuous from the outset. Clinton came into office with a reputation for manipulating the draft laws to avoid service in Vietnam. Clinton, moreover, alienated the military shortly after his inauguration when he suggested he would allow gays to serve openly in the military, which is a forward thinking of him, I have to say. Clinton bowed to military pressure time and again on numerous national security issues. His capitulations weakened or abandoned agreements dealing with the International Criminal Court, a ban on landmines, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, and the Chemical Warfare Convention. Clinton bowed to the Democratic Party's right wing in naming James Woolsey as director of the Central Intelligence Agency. The Pentagon had so little respect for Clinton that in 1994 did not respond to the efforts of the White House to create military options for stopping the genocide in Rwanda or for countering al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. So this is Bill Clinton's role in this back when he was president. It didn't just begin with President Biden. So
we have a caller.
We have a caller on the line.
Marcus.
Hello, you're on the air.
Oh, good morning, Pear.
Hello, who is this?
This is Marcos.
How are you?
We've taken a ride on the time machine. We're back around 60 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It was Kennedy versus Khrushchev. A lot of people have referenced the Cuban Missile Crisis in relation to what's going on now. Both crises completely unnecessary. We know from the history of what happened 60 years ago. Yet right now, it seems like our top foreign policy planners, your Anthony Blinkens, your Victoria Nulands, et cetera, are reading comic books from the 50s about the Red Menace. Picture, if you will, a giant can of red paint being poured over the globe in red paint. Dripping down the sides. That's the International Communist conspiracy. That's what we're up against.
Can I just interrupt briefly here? Apparently, Russia is no longer the Soviet Union. Putin, whatever you may think of him, Putin is a rather conservative guy, and he's not certainly not a red. But go ahead, continue.
Why are you interjecting reality into this conversation? We're talking in a realm of fantasy and dusty paranoia from 60 years ago. There's no relationship whatsoever between the situation today and then in terms of the actuality. But in terms of philosophically framing it, most American planners, as well as most of our news commentators, are acting as if we're right back with the Soviet Union. The idea that communism is over, that doesn't play into it. The very same people that got us into this, that got us into this predicament, are the very same people, or the school of thought, I should say, that got us into Afghanistan 40 years ago. You're the big new Brzezinskis. Anthony Blinken is of that tradition. Henry Kissinger. These are people who see foreign policy as game playing. Zbigniew Brzezinski, who created the whole Afghanistan situation, who decided that it would be a good idea to inject radical Islam into Afghanistan to create a mujahideen, to torment the Russians, to basically create a trap to lure the Russians into Afghanistan. That very same thinking is what we need to do now, is to torment the Russians and torment the Chinese and create drama on both fronts, possibly ending in a nuclear war. We don't know. We came very close to a nuclear war 60 years ago.
That's true. But Kennedy and Khrushchev had the good sense to kind of step back from this confrontation.
That's actually a secret that they did that. If you know the hidden history, you know that they actually did negotiate a de-escalation. Officially, most Americans believe that John Kennedy stood tall in the saddle and stared down Khrushchev, and Khrushchev blinked, and that therefore the Cuban Missile Crisis was a victory for America. We forced the Russian hand, or the Soviet hand. That was a very dangerous game. People looking at the Cuban Missile Crisis understand that we almost blew up the world. We got very lucky that we didn't, but it was a 50-50 chance. There's a possibility we could do that again, and the real risk is that a miscommunication, an accident, signals that are misidentified. If by creating a situation of fear and anxiety on the part of our adversaries in this case, it's bad for everybody, because in any perceived threat coming at the Russians, according to the way things are set up, that they'll respond in kind, that they'll say, oh, we're under a nuclear attack, the belligerent Americans have finally decided to press the button, and the way the game has been played all through the Cold War is when one country is under attack, they're supposed to counterattack. And even if it was a mistake in the beginning, well, it's not a mistake anymore, because it's World War III. So it's an extremely dangerous game. Very, very little commentary seems to be along those lines. But I do feel a need, sorry for rambling on about this, I do feel a need to say that the very same planning that got us into Afghanistan has now left Afghanistan in a horrible situation that very few people are talking about. There are right now 1 million children at acute risk of starving to death this winter. That's 1 million children. It's been estimated that possibly 9 million Afghans in total may not survive the winter. the United States is promoting a famine in Afghanistan, just as we're promoting a famine in Yemen, partnering with our Saudi friends to torment that country. You would think that the stakes of what I'm talking about, either that I'm mistaken, that it's not a million children at imminent risk of famine. There's very little response to this. I mean, this is known. UNICEF is telling us this. The UN is telling us this. World aid organizations are concerned. We have essentially shut down the Afghan economy and created the conditions for mass famine. Most mm-hmm. Afghans right now are food insecure. And again, I said a million children dying. 40%, 41% of Afghan children under the age of five are stunting, are being stunted, which means that they will not grow into whole human beings, that, mm-hmm. that their lives are essentially being cramped to the point where their brains will not develop. That's the current reality. And we live in a country right now where what I'm saying is not being said. Joe Rogan is the preferred area of discourse between liberals and conservatives, or whatever you want to call the political split. There's very little chat on KABU about the famines in Yemen and Afghanistan that are right now ongoing and with no end in sight. Mm-hmm. Our president has just decided to give half of the money that's being held in American banks, Afghan money that we have seized, he's decided to give away half of that money to the survivors of 9/11, which is a political stunt. It has no real relationship in any terms of justice or fairness in terms of who's responsible for 9/11. It certainly wasn't the Afghan people. But this, we're in an absurd time. If you've ever seen the movie Dr. Strangelove, the narrative of Dr. Strangelove goes a long way to explain right now where we are. It's game playing in the most insane possible way, with the stakes being the world itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, then, you know, supposedly, you know, the with all the divisions between different political forces in this world, you know, the world as a whole is facing a climate catastrophe. And you think now would be the time where all the nations would have to get together and do something to avoid this calamity. But it's a weird situation. It's like fighting while the ship is sinking. The passengers are fighting among themselves. It's really tragic, you know. But go ahead.
Well, we have 8 years, according to the consensus of climate scientists, to reduce the world's carbon footprint by half.
Eight years.
Mm-hmm. So, and if you see any indication that we're even taking the very first baby steps towards achieving that target. And it's not enough to half step this. It's not enough to say, oh well, we reduced our carbon footprint by 27% over the mm-hmm. next 8 years, or 35%, or 48%. We need to absolutely get to that place, or we're in a place of irreversible tipping points where you can't go back, where the damage is irreparable. So we have this brief window of opportunity, and the top minds in our country, the top foreign policy planners and advisors, are committed again to reading 1950s comic books about international game playing, finding enemies to stoke up confrontations and tensions and drama with. And you're right, the path towards cutting our carbon footprint in half would be to seek cooperation with the people that we're now confronting belligerently, we would say, oh, how do we partner with the Chinese? How do we partner with the Russians?
Mm-hmm.
This is if we don't blow ourselves up with these senseless, absolutely insane games, we're just wasting time, and that in itself will kill us all.
Mm-hmm.
The failure of imagination, the lack of any basic human decency on the part of the top people in our government, it's an embarrassment. It's outrageous. I don't know how to put more exclamation points behind what I'm saying. And yet it doesn't break the surface. It's not really what we're talking about. It's peripheral. And the people that consider themselves to be the most progressive in America, that's not on their agenda particularly. We're fighting cultural battles where we should be in another place.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I agree with you. Yes, you said as well as anybody. I think this is true. It's we're in a situation now where the future of humanity is kind of is at stake, but still you have different sections of humanity are, think they can take gain some temporary advantage from this, and eventually, I guess the problem will grow until we're blindsided by it, and then it may be too late to do anything. It's really tragic. Supposedly we're supposed to be rational people, the apex of evolution, but we may be possibly the end of evolution, or evolution may take a whole new track unless we do something about it.
Well, President Obama, to his credit, he committed $1 trillion with a T to modernize our nuclear weapons capability.
Mm-hmm.
Get a huge amount of play. But he initiated a 10-year program to make our nuclear weapons faster, more powerful, less detectable, bring us even closer to nuclear apocalypse than we've been.
Mm-hmm.
The Union of Concerned Scientists have set a doomsday clock for many, many decades now, and we've never been closer to the terminal point, which means that all life on Earth ends. One thought I'd also like to share is that the idea of winning a nuclear war is a complete fallacy. That if every nuclear weapon that the United States fires at an adversary hits its target, and the adversary is not able to get a single weapon to reach us, we still lose. That we have a nuclear winter. That we would create conditions of environmental apocalypse, post nuclear exchange, where no one will survive. And that's the logic that we've been living with for any rational person. It's the idea is no, don't go there. That's the end of the world. Mm-hmm. Only a fool would even tempt fate to get anywhere closer to that. But our current thinking, I mean, these are very, very intelligent people, very educated people. They graduate places like the Kennedy School of Government, Tufts Fletcher School of International Diplomacy. These people are deeply, deeply skilled in statecraft, in policy making. They're playing a game of chess with the devil, and they hope to win.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's obscene. It's and again, it's just to ground it. So it's not just something abstract. We're stunting a generation of children in Afghanistan as a parting gift to the mm-hmm. Afghan people after meddling with them for 20 years, completely mm-hmm. unnecessarily. We've decided to say that 9/11 is the sole ownership of the Afghan people. We've partnered with the people that murdered Adam Khashoggi. I thought that would have been a deal breaker with between the United States and the Saudi government.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
We're continuing to partner with them in their destruction of Yemen. We've sent them $750 million worth of bombs that they can use to bomb Yemen.
I hate to interrupt because
we're
getting near the end of the show, and I want to really thank you for some great comments. Can you sum it up in just a few less than a minute, half a minute?
He's gone. We have another caller.
Oh, okay. Well, I think we're at the end of our hour now, or half hour, and I want to thank people for calling and commenting. If there's anybody still left, I'm sorry we didn't get to you, but this has been Fight the Empire, and my name is Per Fogring, and stay tuned to KBOO. It's your radio station. We own it and we operate it. We have a say in what is going on the air. This is our voice on the radio dial, so stay tuned. It's good stuff coming up.
Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon. We feature interviews with leaders in the community.